The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today it's the author of The Prodigal Son, Kimberla Lawson Roby. She's a New York Times best-selling author, and this, another Reverend Curtis Black novel. Kimberla, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, tell me a little bit about Reverend Curtis Black.
Wow. Well, you know, he's a little different today, but when he first started out in the first book in the series, Casting the First Stone, he was this man who was consumed with money, power, and women, and women, and women, to say the least. And so caused lots of problems, obviously, for his wife and for his child, as well as for his congregation. And so now throughout the series, he's continued to have some issues. He's a very, very flawed character. And now that he has really worked to turn his life around, he is reaping every bit of what he has sown. There are consequences, not just for him, but now for his children, who are now adults as well.
Been married three times, according to the book.
Yes, yes. The first wife, Tanya, was a wonderful woman. Loved him, was very loyal and dedicated. She was a great mother. She was just a great first lady for the church. The congregation just loved her. But Curtis, of course, ruined that. She finally had enough and decided to walk away from the marriage, took their daughter, and moved on. He moved on to a second wife and a second church. And again, a wonderful wife who loved him, and that just wasn't good enough. And finally, when he marries his third wife, Charlotte, the tables turn. He marries his match, and this is a woman who's worse than he ever was. And so he is really dealing with that right now.
Reverend Curtis Black, was he, well, I should ask, how many books has he been in so far in the series?
All 11. The Prodigal Son, the newest release, he's in that one as well, although it is told in the voices of his two sons. But yes, 11 titles to date.
Tell me now, when you first started with the good Reverend, was he married to his first wife? How did that work?
Yes, he was. As the story opens, there's a prologue. And so what you learn is that he is right out of college. He's gotten his master's degree. Tanya has as well. And he goes to her to ask her for her hand in marriage. But he tells her that God has called him to preach. And interestingly enough, he's very serious about that. And he's a great man of God, loves God, tries to do the right thing, treats people the way they, you know, that he would want to be treated. But this is when they are still in Atlanta, Georgia, and he only has a congregation of 300 members. And I say only because that's still a lot of members. But when he is offered a position in Chicago with a membership of 3,000, that's when everything starts to change for the worse.
All right, now tell me about his children, because he's got children from a couple different marriages, at least.
Yes, he does. And so there is Alicia, who originally, and you'll understand why, but originally was his firstborn child with Tanya, the first wife. And then he had an affair on Tanya with Charlotte that many years ago, which is who he's married to today. They have a son, Matthew. And then there is Cortina, who he had with another woman that was many years later, and she's just 6-7 years old right now. And then now in this book, readers really get to know Dylan. Dylan is the true firstborn child of Curtis Black that he's only met for the first time a year ago, as well as the rest of the family. This is the child that he denied right after his college years when he knew he was about to marry Tanya, and he just wanted that to go away. This was a woman that he was with he did not love. He had the DNA test manipulated to prove that he was not the father, but now Dylan is here and he wants his rightful place in the family. He wants Curtis's love and his attention, and he's not that happy about the other children. He believes they've already had their time with his dad, and so now it's his turn. When he finds that he's not getting what he's looking for in terms of that love and affection, he really starts to act out in a pretty terrible way.
So does the Reverend like Dylan at all? How does that work? I mean, Dylan doesn't think so.
No, he does not. And really, Curtis does. He cares about him. Curtis truly has turned his life around. He's a compassionate man. He is a great man of God. And he's always been a wonderful father, for the most part, with the other children. But I think Dylan is looking for a little too much too fast. Curtis really just probably needs more time to get to know him. But he does love his son. He's given him a huge amount of money just to even try to start making up for this terrible thing that he did and denying him and not being there for him as a father. But Dylan just really wants it all. And he really wants time with him. He wants Curtis to not spend any more time with the other children. That's really what it ends up being about. He just feels like it should all be about him, you know, for this particular day and time.
So tell me a little bit about the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, where he's at right now, pretty big church, I guess.
Yes, it is. It's a pretty big church, and they're continuing to expand. It's called Deliverance Outreach. And so what Curtis learned early on is that he was being ousted from other churches because of his terrible ways and the things that he was doing to his wife. And so he decided to found his church many years ago, and that's the church that he is still the senior pastor of today. And so it's a great church. You know, they're involved in community. It's one that lots of people in the city want to be members of, especially now that he really has changed for the better. But of course, whenever the problems happen, not only with him and his wife, but with the children, the church is affected. The members are affected, and it's a scandal, and it's humiliation, and it's a lot that they all have to deal with because this is their pastor.
You know, I thought in his church it was kind of a cool idea that the oldest mother, youngest mother, mm-hmm. they get some cash from the church for being more or less in the congregation, I guess.
Yes, they do. And so they just, you know, kind of thought this was a nice idea, something to kind of start doing to recognize that oldest mother in the church and the young mother who's just starting out as a mother. And usually when you're that young of a mother, you're even a new wife. And so you have this new family. But what's interesting is it's been kind of fun to hear from readers saying, gosh, they love that part of it. But nobody thought Charlotte should be getting a dime. And so I think that's kind of the interesting thing about that. She's the first lady of the church, and I think people would be all for it, except they know of so many of the terrible things that she's done.
With mm-hmm. giving money to the congregation like that, mm-hmm. do you know of churches that do that, or was that your own idea? How did that come about?
Well, probably the amounts, you know, that was just my own idea. But yes, I have seen that. I've seen mothers in the church acknowledged, or even if it's just for Father's Day sometimes, you know, maybe this particular older gentleman, maybe he's been a deacon in the church and he's done so much. They may acknowledge him, saying he's almost more or less the father of the church. So, yes.
Well, I've seen roses given out, I think.
Right, just never, ever the cash gift, no, huh?
I want to go to that church. you know, I could be the oldest father here one of these days. You never know, right? All right. This, of course, not based on any church, or maybe it is.
Well, you know, not any one particular church, but I have been in church my entire life. And so I've seen a lot. I've heard a lot. And, you know, for me, I was raised up in a Christian home and I was taught right from wrong. And, you know, to live by the word as much as I could and to treat people the way I wanted to be treated. And so I think it has been pretty easy for me to write about the terrible things that I've known about and heard about. And so Curtis is a mixture of many men of God that I've known and heard about throughout the years. And some of the scenarios that you see, they're never exact in terms of what I know has actually happened. But I'm certainly inspired by the real life situations and even what we now see in the national headlines.
I would guess the Reverend Curtis Black series, not your first series, or am I?
It is.
Wrong?
Yes, it is. And it was never my intention to write a series. So I wrote my first and second books, which had nothing to do with Curtis Black or the church. And this just so happened to be the third topic that I wanted to focus on, corruption in the church. My husband actually suggested it when I said, I want to write something again that my readers feel like they can relate to in their own lives. But this time I want it to be something that everyone will have at least heard about, because it just was kind of time, I think, that I wanted to kind of stretch out a little bit. And so he said, what about all of the issues that go on in churches? Because when you're talking about scandal in church, unfortunately, it crosses all denominations, all financial lines, all color lines. And so that's really how that came about. And so I just kind of moved on, though, after that. Once that book was out, moved on to another book and another book. But readers would be at my events for the fourth and fifth titles, and they'd say, are you ever going to write about the pastor again? You know, what about the family? And what about that church and those members? And they were saying they knew who he was in their own cities, you know, so to speak. And we would laugh sometimes because we'd go to events and the discussions would get pretty lively, and people would sometimes say the names of their pastors, the real names of the pastors, who were just like the Reverend Curtis Black.
That's funny there. Mm-hmm. now, of course, you know, everything that goes on in the church, just like schools, churches, I'm sure, have their own cliques.
Yes, and they do. There's no doubt about it. And I've seen that myself. And, you know, I've been one to really stay away from that. But it's always been kind of interesting that, you know, when I was younger, as well as now as an adult, you can see the same group of people kind of, you know, speaking or kind of grouping together even after service when you're in the fellowship mode, and you'll say, well, you know, you're going to see this woman, this man, or maybe these two married couples, you know, are going to be together. And that's just kind of interesting. And you'll even see it with the children. It starts out at a very young age that people sort of migrate to certain individuals. And unfortunately, too, I have to say that even when trouble starts, you almost kind of know which group that's going to come from. You know who's kind of keeping the gossip going and kind of getting things stirred up. And you know who the people are who you feel like, wow, these are really genuinely nice people who are here for the right reasons.
I think I'd go to the gossipers and just spread a little bit of stuff and watch it grow. That's what I would do.
That's right.
All right, now, you know, talking about the cliques and how everybody gathers together,
mm-hmm.
I can imagine being brand new at a church or maybe going to a church for the first time, because when I go to a church, I see the same people sitting in the same pews all over the place. Now, what
mm-hmm.
happens when that new person comes in and kind of maybe becomes a squatter in another pew?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've not only just had it as a visitor, I've had it happen at my own church before. A few years ago, my husband and I came in and, you know, just really didn't think much about it. We kind of had an area and a side, you know, of the church that we usually sat on, but it just never seemed like it was that big a deal to me to always sit on that exact same pew. And I have to be honest and say, though, I watched my grandmother, my grandfather, well, my grandfather was actually a trustee, so he kind of sat toward the front. The officers of the church kind of all sat together, but my mom and dad, my aunts and uncles, and most of the people that I just grew up with, their parents, you know, they sat in the same area. But Will and I just remember this one Sunday, and so of course, it wasn't like people didn't know us. Everybody knew us at the church. I'd been there since I was a child, and he had been there since he was. And so we came in and we sat down. This woman comes in and her brother, and they do usually sit in that area, and I hadn't thought about it, but they kind of just stood there. They stood there because they wanted us to slide down, because they always sit on that end. And I thought, oh, okay, I get it now. You know, it's just kind of like, wow, you know, and that's just interesting. But you still see that. And people are very serious about, this is my seat. And what if a visitor comes? You know, what does that really say to them? If, you know, I think I would walk away feeling unwelcomed. I think that's what would happen for me.
I guess what would the correct protocol be for a brand new person going to a church? Do they maybe go in late so they can see what might be?
You know, that might be the best thing to do. That's the only way you could sort of be safe. And to be honest, how we ended up on the seat that day of the woman and the man who came in, she and her brother, it was because they were late for a change. And, you know, just didn't even think about it. You just knew that seat was open. And, but yeah, that's probably the best idea, you know, which is unfortunate, because if you're really, really at church for the right reason, does it really matter where you sit at? I would have to ask someone that.
How do you keep the Reverend and all the congregation, all the people that you write about continually in your series? I mean, that's got to be pretty tough sometimes, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is, you know, just to keep them straight and what's going on in each of their lives. And of course, as you continue, for me, I'm writing a book in the series every year. So I only move it pretty much a year ahead. It's pretty much in real time for me. But they all either are getting older, or maybe, you know, they went through something in the last book. And so you can't forget about that. They're kind of still dealing with that possibly a year later. And so I really have to pay attention to it. And believe me, if you don't, your readers will remind you, well, you know what? I kind of remembered about 3 or 4 years ago. Didn't that happen? And that only happened to me one time. And I had to really fix that. You know, the character had to really explain why one thing happened versus another. And it's interesting.
Yeah, they had that facelift or
some sort of
surgery,
like, okay,
or something.
That's right.
So now do you journal this so you can flip through it, you know, before you start writing?
I do. And what I do too, and this really has helped me, is I outline my stories. And I have, of course, writer friends of mine who, you know, tell me, gosh, that would just drive them insane. They don't want to know even a little bit about where they're going. They want to start at page one and keep going to the end. But for me, I do like to outline at least the first 15 or 20 chapters. But in the outline, I'll have the character's name, you know, whether it's a primary character, secondary character, what their relationship is to another character, and I go so on and so on. And so now I can look back and say, oh, okay, that person, yep, that's what their last name was. And, you know, they really were that person's aunt, or that was that person's cousin. And so I really have to keep that and save that so that I can continuously refer back to it.
You know, not only the Reverend Curtis Black novel, and you would think, well, there probably wouldn't be that much of a love interest in this, but these books, this series is pretty hot at times.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it's about the pastor and his wife, and it's the church, and, you know, sometimes it's even, you know, tagged as Christian fiction. A lot of times I see that with the booksellers, retailers, and even with writers, and when people write their blogs. I think it's because, you know, I do keep it free of any profanity. Anytime you do see what we would consider an intimate scene, I mean, it's very tasteful, and you don't graphically see it, so to speak. And so I think that's kind of how that ends up happening. But I say this, I think that it's probably dramatic enough and, you know, a little steamy enough to keep you turning the pages.
It did me.
Yeah.
the Prodigal Son, now this series, would you call it maybe a romance series, or I heard church series in here too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, never really a romance series. And I think because my books don't always end on a happily ever after note, almost never, to be honest. And it is about real life issues. And sometimes it's just not ending up the way people would want, but it happens the way things happen in real life.
Mm-hmm. The Prodigal Son, of course, book number 11 in the series. Mm-hmm. How long do you see the series lasting?
Well, for a little while. I'm actually right now working on the 12th one for May 2015. And then, you know, The Prodigal Son is actually my 20th book. So I kind of alternate. I have my novellas that I release in the fall or at the first part of the year. So I think it'll go on for a little while. But now, the same as this book centers on Dylan and Matthew, the two sons, the book for 2015 will be centered on Alicia, Curtis's oldest daughter, and her ex-husband. And so now that the children have grown up and they have their own lives and their own problems to contend with, is more or less turned into a family saga. And again, that wasn't even planned, but that's what has happened.
So you're doing two books a year?
I do.
So tell me about the other book right before this one. Those are standalone, I would guess.
Yes, they are. So my book that came out before this one, gosh, I had to think about it. Oh, you know what? It was actually A House Divided. I kind of skipped around a little bit because we, like, for example, A Christmas Prayer is coming out in November. So that's my first Christmas book. But before A House Divided, the last Curtis Black book, it was a book called The Perfect Marriage. And The Perfect Marriage was about a couple who were very well educated. They had a beautiful 12-year-old daughter, and they had a happy marriage. They both had six-figure incomes. What they didn't know was the husband was hiding the fact that he was using cocaine, and the wife was hiding the fact that she was abusing Vicodin. And so they both had these addictions, and eventually they learn of it, but it shows how they really eventually ruin their lives, so to speak, and cause major problems for their daughter. And I wanted to write about it because I had not written about drug addiction, but I wanted to write about drug addicts who really don't look like the way we believe they should look like. We believe that, you know, people can't be successful. And if you have a certain amount of money or you're living in a certain type of house, certainly, you know, you wouldn't have that kind of problem. And it's just not true. It shows that drug addiction can affect people across the board.
You would think that the drug addicts would be in the shadows.
Exactly.
And, they're down in the
skid row, down on their luck. Maybe they've lived a certain kind of life all their lives. And I know that's just not true.
How much research did you have to do with drug addiction?
A lot. And so, you know, thankfully now the internet is, you know, there, and it gives you pretty much everything you want to know, from, you know, how much someone would have to take to really be considered an addict, or, you know, how does it start out? Usually people start out thinking that they're doing it on a social basis, or in my character's case, the wife's, she fell on some ice and had a major hip injury and started from there. Never had had a problem before, but one thing led to another. And next thing you knew, she was doing it, even though she wasn't even having pain anymore. The husband was dealing with some other stress and personal issues in his life. And that's how he sort of started dabbling a little bit with cocaine. But I also had to talk to people who were in recovery. That's where I got the most understanding of what it's been like from the beginning to where they were in their lives at this point today.
Heroin, probably the worst drug mm-hmm. that you can get on. Probably talk to heroin
yes,
addicts.
Yes, because it does seem like, for whatever reason, when people are shooting, you know, drugs intravenously, that kind of takes people to a whole other level. That's for sure.
And they never do seem to get off of it, or maybe they do, but it's
tough. It's an everyday fight. For example, I talked with a guy who had a heroin addiction and had been able to go into recovery and, you know, had gotten help and was actually in treatment and was doing all that he needed to do. Well, unfortunately for him, he ended up having a back problem. And so it just had gotten, the pain become so severe that he ended up on painkillers, and that led him right back into it. And you think, gosh, you know, can a person ever kick that? And this is a man who's in his 60s. This is not a young person. This is somebody who has fought with this most of his life.
Even a president's wife, and you have sports figures and even mm-hmm. People that you might look up to, movie stars or
yes.
something like that. It is all around, it is a sad mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. So with that book, do you go in, is there kind of a lesson learned in, especially maybe even in all your books?
Mm-hmm. And I do. And you know what's always interesting too is that I always hope that there will be this lesson learned. And I do hear that from readers, and I certainly have with The Perfect Marriage. But I think what I learned more than anything is that, gosh, I did kind of think a little more than I realized that this just didn't happen to certain people. You know, who become successful, who gets a great education, who has a great job and is willing to risk it and throw it all away. I just didn't have a full understanding of that. And I think I thought that it was a little easier. You know, why couldn't people just say, look, this is ruining my life. This is ruining my family's life. I'm going to give this up. And I learned very quickly that it's just not that easy. Most people don't want to lose everything that they have, but they just have a hard time stopping what it is they're doing.
Well, Kimberly, I mean, you look like you probably started writing, I mean, 20 books or so, probably when you were right out of high school.
No, no. That's such a nice compliment. I love it. I'm going to take that now. That's going to get me through the rest of the week. But I was actually 30. So I was 30 years old in 1995. And, you know, I come by way of corporate America. I had worked in the business arena for a while. I worked for the state of Illinois and ultimately worked as a financial analyst for the city of Rockford, Illinois, where we live. So it had not been a lifelong dream of mine to become a writer, but I just always felt like something was missing, whether I was working in marketing, finance, it didn't matter. I loved those jobs, but I still felt like I was supposed to be doing something else. And just started thinking back as early as elementary school teachers who had said, you have a gift for storytelling, you have a gift for writing, and you should follow through with it, you should do more with it. Same thing continued through junior high, high school, and even in college, and I just never paid a lot of attention to it. But finally, one day I thought I'd kind of, you know, give it a try and sat down and just started doing it on a part-time basis.
So I guess maybe did you journal at all before or anything like that?
Not so much. No, I really started out with just writing a book, which was a little different. I even hear from a lot of, you know, editors that I've worked with now that, you know, usually people have tried to get short stories published or they've written newspaper articles or even just an op-ed piece. And I just started out with writing a book. So it was a little different.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, From business to being an author, what was the challenge with that? And maybe even what was the challenge writing that first book as opposed to maybe the last book? What was the biggest challenge for you?
Well, you know, I think I didn't have so much of a challenge with it, but I do think that because it was my first book, I was just a little more in tune and focused that, gosh, I could stick with this. I was determined. So every day I came home from work and I would write, and I would do it on the weekends and the holidays. And I just kept with it for 7 months until the book was complete. Now, you know, there's so much more involved. There is the promotion of the book. There are the interviews. There are the national tours. And of course, now with social media, I'm constantly communicating with my readers. And I do that because I love that part of it so much. And it has become more personal. You know, I'm allowed to have a more personal relationship with them. So there's so much time involved. And of course, that takes away from the writing. And next thing you know, days have passed by and weeks have passed by, and you have this deadline in your contract and you know you need to get going with it. And so I think that's the difference. I have more of a challenge today in trying to just balance everything out that goes along with being an author.
So 2 books a year, what do you do with your free time?
Well, the free time, you know, my favorite place to be is at home. And I think a lot of times my readers laugh because they think, well, what exotic place would you like to be at? You know, what do you like to do for vacation? But I love to be at home. And maybe it is because we travel so much and I, you know, get to go around and meet my readers and do the various events. And so a really great day for me is when I have nothing going on except a marathon day of Law and Order SVU, you know, or just Law and Order, depending on whether it's Tuesday or Thursday. So I'm really a homebody by nature. And so I've really seemed to become one now when I'm at home.
You're a great cook?
No, not so much. I wish I could say that. More my husband is, though. He is just great at that. He always has been. And, you know, I can do a few things. Like, I loved baked salmon. So, of course, I've learned to do that well. And you learn to cook, I think, the things that you love so much. But no, he's really the cook in the household.
Well, you know, of course, The Prodigal Son, your brand new book, a Reverend Curtis Black novel. You've got a Christmas novel coming out next. Of course, another Reverend Curtis Black novel about number how many on that?
12, that'll be 13? 12, yes.
12. Wow. So, you know, these books, they're fun to read. They're fantastic. I mean, the storyline is great. If somebody wanted to find out about The Prodigal Son, your other books, who is the Reverend Curtis Black? And maybe you've got people out there that are just fantastic fans that love the book, but maybe they don't know how to find out more information. Where do they go?
Well, they can go to my website, which is www.kimrobey.com. So there, it's pretty informative. All of the books are out there, all 20 titles, but also there are chapter excerpts for every one of them, so readers can try them out, see what they might be interested in. My entire tour schedule is there, any new updates, anything about upcoming books. The links for both my Facebook and Twitter pages are listed as well.
I see what Kimberly is trying to do. She's trying to get you to the website, check out the first chapters or so. You're going to be hooked, and you're going to want to get the whole series of the Reverend Curtis Black. Hey, you know what? The Prodigal Son, you should start with the very first one, but hey, these are pretty much standalones anyway. I got right into it myself. Great writer, Kimberly Lawson Robey. Kimberly, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Been listening to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Kimberly Lawson Robey, author of her brand new book, The Prodigal Son. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.